The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. It's a true delight. My name is Lauren Grodstein. I'm a writer and an English and creative writing professor at Rutgers Camden, just over the bridge. It is my pleasure to welcome you here tonight to the Free Library. If you could all turn off your cell phones, that way we know that if the cell phone that rings is mine. Great, you look like cell phones are off. Terrific, okay. I'm here to introduce Joshua Ferris this evening. In his sharply observant and deeply humane fiction, Joshua Ferris both celebrates and then eviscerates the fundamentals of American life. First, in his National Book Award nominated novel, Then We Came to the End, Ferris examined the way we work, our career ambitions, our scheming, our office gossip, our office parties, and the way we so often build deeper connections with our coworkers than we do with our own children. The book, which won the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award and the Barnes & Noble Discover Award, instantly established Ferris as one of the most exciting writers of his generation. Now, in his new book, The Unnamed, Ferris turns his attention to marriage and to the way a terminal illness can make a husband and wife closer and then shred everything they think they know about one another. It is intimate and it is terrifying. The Unnamed is just one of those books that will not let you put it down. It is relentless, it is moving, it is powerful, proving again that in skilled hands, even the saddest of stories becomes a thing of great beauty. I'm so glad to know Josh as a colleague, a friend, and a fan, and I really look forward to hearing him read tonight. I welcome Josh Ferris.
This thing looks like something, I was just saying that it looks like something my parents would put cheese on. I'm slightly prone to the sentimental impulse, which is not always a good thing. But before I start reading, I'm going to read something that's distinctly not mine for the sake of a eulogy. This is from The Catcher in the Rye. If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all that before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth. In the first place, that stuff bores me, and in the second place, my parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all, I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell. Besides, I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me around last Christmas, just before I got pretty run down and had to come out here and take it easy. I mean, that's all I told DB about, and he's my brother and all. He's in Hollywood. That isn't too far from this crummy place, and he comes over and visits me practically every weekend. He's going to drive me home when I go home next month, maybe. He just got a Jaguar, one of those little English jobs that can do about 200 miles an hour. It cost him damn near $4,000. He's got a lot of dough now. He didn't used to. He used to be just a regular writer when he was home. He wrote this terrific book of short stories, The Secret Goldfish, in case you never heard of him. The best one in it was The Secret Goldfish. It was about this little kid that wouldn't let anybody look at his goldfish because he'd bought it with his own money. It killed me. Now he's out in Hollywood, DB, being a prostitute. If there's one thing I hate, it's the movies. Don't even mention them to me. So this is from The Unnamed, and I'm afraid I need to do a little preamble so that you can possibly understand what the hell it is I'm talking about. I'm going to read sort of toward the back of the book. So, the guy that is my main character is suffering from a disease. The disease makes him walk, So he's forced by his body to just sort of go wherever his body takes him. And then he falls asleep, and upon waking up, he sort of drops from exhaustion. Upon waking up, calls his wife, and his wife comes and gets him. At a certain point in time in the book, he sort of releases his wife from that obligation and wanders according to his body's prerogative. And then he wakes up, and he has some downtime, just like we all do when we wake up, to do with himself what he will. And then the walk takes him again, and it's a cycle that repeats itself every day. So I think that's probably all you really need to know. His name is Tim, and he's married to his wife, Jane, and they have a daughter, Becca, and they all factor into this part. He passed up diners and hotels and the idle hour of rest in bars and bowling alleys because indulgence in the creature comforts during his downtime made him sluggish and contrarian when it came time for his body to walk. He continued to think, I'm winning, or today, he won, depending on how well his mind, his will, his soul, he did not know the best name for it, fought against the lesser instincts of his body. He, or it, or whatever you wanted to call it, but certainly not I, he thought, still bellyached for food, it still needed water, it complained of soreness in the joints and muscles. He tended to its needs while trying not to spoil it. He made every effort to remember a time when he was not just the sum of his urges. I guess I don't understand why it hasn't gone into remission. It went into remission before, his wife said to him on the phone. You'd expect it would go into remission again, and then you could come home and we could pick up where we left off. That would kill me. Why? Because if it went into remission, it would come back, and I don't want to have to do it all over again. Do what? Resign myself to it, he said. Resign myself to doing it all over again. You wouldn't have to, she said. We could make it work. Go on with your life, he said. And do what? Sell houses, he said. She was a realtor. Be happy. Remarry. There was a pause on her end. I can't believe you'd say that. I'm out here now, he said. I'm doing what I have to do. You should do the same. He stood outside a big multiplex reading the listings and showtimes. He was not current with the popular reviews, but he could distinguish from the titles the political thriller from the romantic comedy from the animated feature. He badly wanted to be inside. There was a comfy seat in there for him and plenty of warmth. The distraction of mindless entertainment promised to shuffle off a pair of hours that might have otherwise been spent dwelling dully on a bench. Against his better judgment, he bought a ticket. He lost interest within 15 minutes and dozed. He woke up to the credits and walked across the hall to a different screen and sat down before a story of intrigue whose plot was even more sophisticated for his having missed the first half. When that show was over, he exited the building and bought a second ticket. He saw another show and half of a fourth before he was forced out of the warm plush oblivion into a torrid pace more odious for the dumb comfort that had preceded it. He resolved never to indulge himself again. Then he woke and decamped and felt the blank expression of eternity boring through him again, downtime's merciless black hole eyes, and in a small misfortune of time, he drank himself into a state watching a game on a bar TV. After letting the dead battery languish a long time, he bought more minutes from an authorized retailer located beside a mattress store. He was unable to reach her on her cell, so he tried her at the office, and there they informed him that she had left months earlier for another firm. He dialed the number the old firm gave him, and a casual voice answered. He was informed that Jane was on vacation and wouldn't be returning for another week. Did he care to speak to a different broker? How nice, he said. Where on vacation? I want to say Paris, but don't quote me, said the voice. The south of France, maybe? He stood in the snow-patched prairie with the ice-blue brook running toward the rafting centers and trailer parks, far from the south of France, far from Paris, and a wave of death washed over him. not biological death, which brought relief, but the death that harrows the living by giving them a glimpse of the life that they've been denied. Its sorrow was a thousandfold any typical dying. He pocketed the phone and walked slowly toward the russet uplands rising in the distance. Ravines in the granite of a north-facing slope sprouted green fronds in feathered clusters. He leaned back against the rock face and felt like crying. She was only resuming life. In the many months that passed between phone calls, she had done just as he had told her to do. He had no one to blame for it but himself. He walked about the prairie until he got a decent signal. His daughter, Becca, was on a tour bus when his call came in. "Hello," she said. "Is your mother on vacation? Dad? Where's your mom? Where are you? Who cares where I am?" "I do," she said. "Can't you imagine I might be curious? After all this time, can't you imagine?" "I'm in a field," he said. "What more is there to say?" She was silent. "Mom's in France." "On vacation?" "Yes." "What's she doing there?" "She's on vacation," she said. "What's the name of the hotel she's staying at?" She paused again. "Why do you want to know that?" "I want to call her." "What for?" "Did she go there alone?" he asked, "or with someone?" Again she paused. "Becca?" "With someone," she said. He bought a used car from a local dealership, wreathed in flag bunting. He was dragged away from it by a long walk, and afterwards, during his downtime, he looped back without sleeping. His body cried out for the rest it demanded, but he was determined to trump its dumb, singular want by keeping constant attention on the pain of the living death he would suffer until he found his way back to her. But he was too tired to drive straight to New York and did not make it 100 miles before falling asleep. The road curved around while he kept straight. He went through a wire fence into a field where he struck a cow. The car undercut its hind legs and lifted the animal off the ground. It hit the hood and the windshield shattered into a cobweb. He slammed on the brakes and the beast caromed off. He stepped out, bleeding and dazed, and approached the animal, which lay flat, legs broken, and stared back at him with an unblinking eye that began to drip blood. He bent down and put both hands on it as if trying to keep the life inside, but the movement of its moist nostrils died out, and with it any final hope that he might make it back home. She called and called again. He let the phone ring into voicemail. He let the battery die. His right eye closed up from conjunctivitis, and the pharmacist recommended that he see an ophthalmologist, but he settled for non-prescription drops that took effect slowly. Passing a downtown bank with an electronic clock, he noticed the date. He counted backward. 16 days earlier, it had been his birthday. He recharged the battery using the men's room outlet in a visitor's center. He discovered 14 messages waiting for him. One was from Becca wishing him a happy birthday. The others were from Jane. He had meant to be self-preserving, not cruel, in not calling her back, but he understood now that he could not have it both ways. Still, he waited. The sun infused the green skin of the tent. He was staring up at it, preparing himself to rise and pack, when the phone rang. He answered in a voice he hadn't heard in days, maybe weeks. She spoke faster than he was accustomed to. "Do you think I wanted this to happen?" she said. "I wanted you. How many times have I called you since I came back from France? 20? "I'm not trying to be heartless," she said. "This thing with Michael, it just happened. These things happen. Do you know how long you've been gone? Do you know how it gets lonely? It gets so lonely. I didn't intend this," she said. "I kept telling you to come home. You told me to remarry. Go on with your life," you said. "Well, that's what I did. I went on with my life. I went to France with a man I like. Can you blame me for that? You can't, because you told me to. I'm not in the wrong here. All you had to do was come home, Tim. I kept telling you that. Come home. I'm telling you now. None of this matters. France, it doesn't matter. It was nice being taken care of for a while, that's all. I would be lying if I said it wasn't nice, but it's not what I want. I want you. Say you'll come home and I'm yours. I'll come get you. I've always been willing to come get you wherever you are. Are you there?" He didn't reply. Say something. You won't call me back, and when you finally pick up the phone, you won't even talk. Say something. Please, say what you're thinking. I'm happy for you, Banana, he said. She began to cry into the phone. I'm sorry, she said. I'm so sorry. I never imagined one of us taking a vacation without the other, he said. Her sob came from deep down in her chest. He told her she had nothing to be sorry for. She was exactly right. He had told her to do it. Can't you come home? I can't. Can't or won't? I honestly can't, he said. The call ended. He had told her to go on with her life only because her love and constancy had been so true for so long, he never dreamed they would actually be taken away. She called a few months later to see if he would agree to make their separation official. Michael had asked her to marry him. He was quiet. Finally, he said that a few days prior he had passed a mailbox, etc., where he thought he could open up a mailbox. She could have the paperwork sent there. Are you sure you don't mind? I don't mind, he said. Maybe the lawyer can just fax it. Either way, he said. He spent a few days walking back to the mailboxes, etc., during his downtime, and then called her with a fax number. I'm not asking for anything, she said. He didn't understand what she meant. Then it dawned on him that she meant money. You should take what you need, he said. I'll sign whatever you send me. I don't need anything, she said. He walked, and after he woke, he returned to the mailboxes, etc., and found the fax waiting for him. The woman at the counter was also a notary public, and together they signed the paperwork. Then he paid to have it faxed back to the lawyer. He stopped in the alleyway and removed the phone from his pocket. The battery was dead, and he hadn't bothered to recharge it for some time, maybe 2 months. He stood considering it a while before tossing it inside a hollow dumpster, where it hit with a cheap and lonely echo. He moved off, past the kids playing catch. He turned right, and his presence was replaced by that window of space, no longer than a car's length, in which cars passed one another all day long, shooting off little sunbursts of glare. He watched Becca from the back of the crowd. He wore his beard and snow cap and backpack, as if his age were not sufficient enough to set him apart. He was drowsy. He had stayed put, approximately, near this ground zero, going on 10 days. When he found himself 12 or 15 miles out, he fought the urge to crash, turned around, and walked his body back. Deprived of sleep, his body was pliable. It was his again. It was also sleep-deprived, and he struggled to retrace the dozen miles. He was not only tired on his return, but weak and hungry, too. She wore army surplus pants and a denim jacket and a faded T-shirt that said, Heavenly Lake Tahoe. She was moody and focused, and she punished the mic stand. She moved around with iconic revolt as if the world that contained her was that murky, bluish stage, and she was thrashing and screaming for release. She removed her denim jacket, and her T-shirt was soaked at the pits. She had gained back her weight and more. He drifted over to where the crowd was thinner and rested his head against the wall and dozed standing despite the enormous sound. To his surprise, she clung to him desperately outside the venue. She broke down in his arms while he worried that his clothes might smell. I'm sorry that it's been so long. You're so thin, she said, releasing him, but gripping his arms as if she feared that he might slip away. They sat in a booth along the far wall of a Greek diner. Periodic voltage drops grayed the gold fixtures and darkened the cake display. Everyone at some point looked ceilingward. She asked him if it was gone, and he said it wasn't. Then how did you make the show? I've been circling the city since you posted the tour dates, he said. I turn around and walk back. Without sleeping? Part of the challenge, not sleeping. When do you sleep? When I get close enough. And what do you do with your downtime? Get closer. And then you walk away again? He nodded. Isn't that exhausting? He shrugged. Gives the day its purpose, he said. It was an act of willful defiance, this looping, this circling back, keeping within a certain perimeter. It imposed a pattern on the random arrivals and departures, even if that pattern was just to see a show or to pick up a few pieces of mail from a P.O. box. He was collecting P.O. boxes, he told her, all across the country, the way other men collected stamps and cans. "Speaking of which," he said. He unzipped the pack and brought out a freezer bag. He removed the two CDs he had ordered over the internet. He showed her that he had uploaded them to his iPod as well. "I also have the concert tee and the poster of the show you did in San Francisco." She was surprised and touched. "You're a good dad," she said. He demurred, "Just a fan. I thought you only liked David Bowie." "That was in the room," he said, remembering the months he spent in the hospital bed and the music she had introduced him to. "Out here, I listen to everything." He put the CDs back in the freezer bag and returned them to the pack. The power dropped out again and didn't return. There was a stir as people murmured and faded to shadows and shifted unsurely in the murk. The waitress came over. "Your order didn't go through, hon." "That's okay," said Becca. "Are you okay?" she asked him. "I'm okay. Can we just have some more coffee?" He wondered in the dim light when her weight had come back. "You look wonderful," he said. "There's more of me anyway," she said. He didn't reply immediately. Then he said, "Does it still bother you?" She puffed out her cheeks like someone about to burst, eyes popping wide. Then she settled into a grin shaded with resignation. "It's my one go-around," she said. "What do? Hate yourself to the bitter end?" "I've always thought you were the most beautiful girl in the world. You've always been biased." "I'm glad you don't hate yourself," he said. "Acceptance," she said. She shrugged. "It's a bitch." Out in the parking lot, she offered to give him a ride, but he needed to be no place. Occasionally, he stayed the night in a motel or at the YMCA, and she tried to encourage him to do so that night, but he said it was easy to fall back into the custom of television and a real bed, which later made his nights in the tent harder to reckon with. He was happier avoiding those comforting places, and he no longer did cars. "What does that mean, you don't do cars?" "They're not an option," he said, thinking back on the dead cow. "If I need to be somewhere, I walk." "Not an option?" She rattled her enormous collection of keys in an unspoken admission that what he said was deeply strange to her. "Well, will you at least sit in the front seat with me a minute?" she asked. "There's something I need to tell you." Her mother was sick. She had debated a long time over whether it made sense telling him. She knew his limitations, and she didn't want him to feel guilty about what was out of his hands. "Is it serious?" "It's cancer." "I don't know what that means," he said. "You don't know what cancer means?" "No, of course I know. I've just lost track." "Lost track of what?" He paused. "What does the man say?" "What man?" "The man she married." "Michael?" she said. "She never married Michael." "She didn't?" He was taken aback. "Why not?" "I don't know the details, Dad. She broke things off." How long had it been, he wondered. He had lost track. He looked out the window and down at the parking lot. He would soon get out of the car and remain there. Becca would drive away, and an empty evening ache would press down. And there was nothing he could do for either of them, for any of them. He turned to look at his daughter. "There's nothing I can do," he said. "I'm not asking you to do anything. I just thought you'd want to know." "I don't," he said. He entered a town of cattle murals and savings banks where he bought a mocha frappuccino. He walked with a coffee drink between a double row of single-story houses, many of which were for sale. The gate to one hung open. The realty sign was strangled under an unmown thicket, and a stained mattress lay on the front porch. He stretched out on the mattress and finished the mocha while watching a black squirrel with a frayed tail fitfully stalk the trees. A man with a cane came out of the house opposite. The old man sat on the porch and turned to his left, then to his right, then to his left again, with a cane between his legs and his hands on top of the brass handle. Then the old man stood, and with the deliberation of a man whose life had narrowed to a single task, he broomed pooled water from the porch. He sat down again to inspect the neighborhood. Eventually, he went back inside. Tim rose from the mattress and left the yard. He went back into town, passing the murals on the sides of the buildings, mostly of cattle and horses, but one of Native Americans. He stopped in a camping supply store and bought another pair of boots, adhesive reflector strips, a new tent, rain gear, energy bars, an additional base layer and pullover, and a compass. He replaced the old goods with his new purchases inside the pack. to be more than the sum of his urges. Part of the challenge, not sleeping. Something guaranteed to expend his considerable energies and lend purpose to the day. He loved her. He had always loved her. To return to her before she died, that would be the last thing ever required of him. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lisa Zeidner, also of Rutgers University in Camden, and I'm delighted to introduce tonight Jonathan Dee, who I think rushed to Philadelphia after a fiction workshop at Columbia University from New York City and just made it, right? John is the author of five novels, The Lover of History, The Liberty Campaign, St. Famous, Palladio, and hot off the press, The Privileges. Different as these books are, they could all be called novels of ideas in that each posits a character in the red-hot center of our cultural and political issues. Dee's characters eat creative dinners and fall in love while watching ugly little foreign wars on TV. They're kidnapped and find themselves in the middle of media tornadoes, hardly recognizing the selves they see on the evening news. Indeed, John is something of a specialist in the distortions of advertising and media. His last novel, Palladio, concerns an advertising genius who's trying to revolutionize the business so the name of the product need never be mentioned. Jonathan Dee has never been afraid of an unsympathetic character. Let lesser writers have their dashing, brilliant, kind, generous heroes and heroines. John's interest has always been more morally complex characters, layered people with thorny contradictions who are often hard to love. Let's remember that he started writing The Privileges way before Bernie Madoff paraded before us in his baseball cap. But with this novel, Jonathan Dee once again puts himself in the forefront of a national conversation, this time about money markets, banking, and greed. Adam Morley is a filthy rich private equity expert who gets filthy richer on account of some inside trading that he insists is perfectly legitimate of victimless crime. If you want somebody to dislike, how about a guy whose teenage kids can call not just for a driver to pick them up when they get in trouble drunk, but a private jet? Yet Adam is a family man who does everything he claims for his wife Cynthia, to whom he is never unfaithful, for his children April and Jonas, and who also runs a hugely influential international charity. The Privileges puts us squarely into the Morley family's world and worldview in ways that are often startling and always interesting. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Dee.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you all for coming. The Privileges covers about 20 years in the lives of the Morey family, and the scene I'm going to read tonight takes place when Adam and Cynthia are somewhere around 30 years old, living in Manhattan. They have two small children. Adam is working at this point for a small and somewhat eccentric private equity firm called Perini Capital. It's run by a man named Barry Sanford, an older man, old enough to be Adam's father, as it occurs repeatedly to Barry himself. Cynthia is doing a little less well at this point, having dropped out of the workforce to stay at home with their kids. She finds it difficult, more psychologically difficult than anything else, to go back and start again. And as a result, she's become a kind of morosely intense mother. Unhappiness of this sort, really of any sort, is something that Adam is sensitive to but doesn't really know how to deal with. So I think the only other things you need to know in order to make sense of this scene are that Adams recently, or is in the process of finishing a deal involving a company called Wisconsin Cryogenics, which is run by a guy known around the office only as Guy from Milwaukee. Guy from Milwaukee, his biggest drawback is that he tends to get sued for sexually harassing his employees. And also, though the reasons why this is relevant won't become clear till the very end, not long ago Adam's own father suffered his third and fatal heart attack. Each December, Sanford took them out to lunch one by one and gave them their bonus checks, along with a kind of performance review, known among the staff as the State of the Career Address, that helped explain the amount. The business itself was his whim, and while they all knew that it had been a profitable year, there was no expectation that the relative size of the bonuses reflected anything more precise than Sanford's own fondness for them. They were good enough friends to joke about their fear. The whole operation was so mercurial that it wouldn't have been outside the realm of possibility for one of them to be fired at his or her bonus lunch, or for all of them to be handed a severance check and told that Sanford had decided to shut the place down. Adam, whose lunch was scheduled for the Friday before Christmas, was on a roll. He'd put together the first round of financing for a generic drug startup that was poised to get huge in a way few people other than Adam had foreseen, and he'd set up a friendly takeover of Wisconsin Cryogenics, friendly enough to keep the volatile guy from Milwaukee in teenagers and blow for the rest of his life. The hardest part about putting that together was getting Guy to keep his mouth shut about it so the stock wouldn't overreact and screw the deal. Sanford took Adam to Boulay, where they split two bottles of wine before the boss produced a check in a glassine envelope. "Open it," he said immodestly, as if there were a ring inside. Adam opened it and saw it was for $350,000. It was much more than he was expecting or had received in previous years, and he'd heard enough to know that none of his colleagues had gotten anything close to it. "This is between you and me," Sanford said unnecessarily. In his old age, he cried more easily. "This is not about the past year. This is about the future. I need to make sure you aren't going anywhere. I need to be sure you know how you're valued. I'm getting to the point where I need to think about the legacy that I leave in this world." Like a lot of his peers, Sanford maintained his social profile through lavish entertainments tied to charities. It wasn't long after bonus season, when presumably they were all feeling flush, that his employees were dunned to buy tickets to that spring's annual benefit for an organization close to his heart, the Boys and Girls Clubs of New York, to be held on the deck of the Intrepid, the decommissioned aircraft carrier that served as a floating naval museum at one of the Hudson River piers. $1,000 a head. For those who worked at Perini, it was not an invitation there was any question of refusing. Adam bought a ticket for Cynthia as well. Normally, he wouldn't have forced her hand like that, but he needed to see a little of the old Cynthia, radiant at a party, for her sake, but also for his own. She was so down these days, and though for the life of him he couldn't see what there was to be down about, he was so used to being grounded by her that he had a real fear that wherever she was drifting, he'd end up drifting right out there along with her. He couldn't figure out what to try, other than maybe to reenact an evening when she was happier. It wasn't much of a plan, but for that night at least it seemed to work. Cynthia was beaming as she shivered in a black dress in the hangar-like space below the deck of the ship, drinking some kind of themed martini, the center of attention among Adam's colleagues from Perini, none of whom had sprung for the extra grand for a date. They took turns asking her to dance. He could see how smitten they were with her, with the idea of her, proof of life after marriage. Even when they got a little drunk and their gaze became a little more direct, it did not occur to him to feel jealous, because she deserved their attention. They ate rack of lamb. They saw Tiki Barber. Sanford and his wife came magnanimously by their table, everyone happily drunk. "One of these things is not like the other," Sanford said, smiling rakishly at Cynthia. "What are you doing at this table full of empty tuxedos?" He held out his hand to her, and when she held out hers, he kissed it. Victoria, his wife, smiled into the middle distance. "So nice to see you again, Barry," Cynthia said. "Please, the pleasure is all mine. You were the absolute jewel of this sorry gathering. Let me ask you something. Do you dance?" "Not really." "Splendid. Son," he said to Adam, "you don't mind if I make off with your wife for a while, do you?" "Adam may not have told you this, but I am a dance instructor par excellence, among my many talents." He held out his elbow. Cynthia, with a mock frightened glance at her husband, put down her martini and glided off on Sanford's arm toward the dance floor. Victoria saw a friend a few tables away, or pretended to, and she waved and chirped and left the table without a word. "Unbelievable," Parker said, as a coworker of Adam's, not without a little envy in his voice. "Fucking old goat, and with his wife right there, too. Amazing what that guy gets away with." Parker's bonus, Adam knew, was so insultingly small that he had skipped right over resentment and moved straight to terror. He emptied another martini and beckoned to the waitress with the empty glass. "There's no buzz," he said to Adam, "like that good cause buzz." "True dat," Adam said. In fact, though, the drunker he got, the more restless and vaguely surly he began to feel, which was unusual for him. He could feel himself smiling, so he stopped. There was a bar up on deck as well, and he headed outside to visit it, just to get away from the table for a few minutes. On the stairs, he turned and was able to pick out his boss and his wife on the crowded dance floor. It was a field of tuxedos, but his eyes were drawn right to them. He watched Sanford turn her around and around in that small space. He said something that made her laugh. It made Adam nostalgic. All the energy and heedlessness and faith in herself that he had always adored had lost its outlet, and so that faith had backed up, as it were, into the lives of the children. What was worst was that the life of maximized potential they had always believed in for themselves was still right there in front of them, closer than ever, really. But she had stopped looking forward to it. She wouldn't even lift her head to see it. When he told her about the bonus, she had mustered a polite smile and whistled, like, "How nice for you." It was both thrilling and a little sad to see her out there dancing like her old self, drunk and luminous, because it took a crazy setting like this, a fantasy almost, to bring it out of her again. Maybe life needed to better resemble the fantasy. Not that there was some $1,000 gala to go to every night, but whatever it was that had to be done, it was his turn to bail her out. She'd bailed him out in more ways than he could count. He couldn't picture what he might have become without her. He knew his boss well enough to have no doubt that seducing Cynthia was the one and only thing on his mind right now. It didn't bother him, not just because he knew it would never happen. It was right, somehow, that that was what Sanford should try to do, regardless of the fact that his wife was standing right there, or of his love for Adam, or the presence of hundreds of onlookers. That was the point of a life like Sanford's. You pursued what you wanted. Up on the deck, there was some kind of disturbance in the line for drinks. A frat boy type in front of Adam was complaining to his friends that the kid at the front of the line, who looked about 19 years old, was chatting up the bartender. "Mac on your own time, Junior," he said. "Some of us are thirsty here." The kid turned around. He had a huge nose, one of those noses that starts practically on the forehead, but on him it looked sort of Roman and oddly handsome. "Take it easy there, Bluto," he said, and Adam's eyes widened gleefully at the audacity of it. "She's my sister." "What?" Bluto said. "I'm not shitting you," the kid said. "I think we're twins." Though he had his drink in hand, he turned back and started murmuring to the bartender again. Another Wall Street tyke, Adam thought. Another kid blowing his bonus money on a party where he thinks he'll network with people who don't even know he's alive. The whole bonus thing got to him, actually, in a way it hadn't before. He'd been given a big bonus this year. What did that even mean? Maybe he should buy himself a sailboat or find more expensive hotels to stay in during the few weeks a year he was allowed to travel where he wanted instead of Charlotte or Omaha, or see if he could find an even more overpriced school to send his kids to. He felt like a sap. Everybody acted like the amount mattered, when what mattered was the notion of getting a bonus at all, of being outside that small circle wherein it was decided how much a man's work was worth, how close you would come to some goal somebody else had set for you. Sanford could have given him $2 million, and the principle would still be the same. Meanwhile, time was going by, and the life around you started to calcify, while the Barry Sanfords of the world paid you to wait to be told what would happen next. His relationship to drinking had grown complicated. The more he felt he wanted one, the more he tried not to have it. It was a self-control exercise, of course, but also he was working out more and more lately, and drinking, and especially hangovers, were incommensurate with the plan to get into perfect shape. He weighed less and could lift more now than 10 years ago. One day off from his routine, though, and he could feel the backslide beginning. Even now, standing in the bar line in a tuxedo, he had a restless urge to descend through the loud metal innards of this impotent ship and, once out on the thin path that ran between the Hudson and the West Side Highway, go for a run. When Bluto got to the front of the line, he pushed the kid aside. Just a nudge, really, but the kid was so much smaller that he stumbled and lost about half his drink on the floor. He put the glass down on the bar, and for a moment, Adam thought the kid was drunk enough to do something seriously stupid. Instead, though, he stuck out his hand. "No hard feelings, bro," he said to Bluto. And when Bluto scowled and shook his hand, the kid reached up with his other hand and clapped Bluto on the shoulder. Then he wandered off, not toward the tables, but in the direction of the moribund planes, some of them spotlit, welded onto the deck as exhibits. Adam continued to stare after him, not so much intently as distractedly, and then suddenly the kid turned around and caught him at it. A few strange seconds passed, strange in that it seemed less awkward than it probably should have. The kid raised his eyebrows, and then, Adam was absolutely sure of it, As he started to walk away again, he held up his right hand, opened it up by raising his fingers as one might open up a book of matches, and there, facing out from his palm, looped around a couple of his fingers, was a wristwatch. No way. Bluto turned away from the bar again to head back into the crowd, holding three beers by their necks in one hand. "Have a good night, G," he said to Adam. "You too. Hey, do you have the time?" Bluto shook his thick wrist out of his sleeve and held it up in front of his face. It was bare. "Holy fuck," he said. Adam left him there, pushing everyone backward while he searched the deck for his expensive watch. He got about halfway back to his own table before he stopped. It took a second in that sea of tuxes, but he could pick out his colleagues sitting at the Perini table with their heads close together, probably in some timid bitch fest about something. They didn't see him. Cynthia must still have been dancing. Adam turned around and walked back into the darkness, punctuated by the hulks of old Mustangs and helicopters and fighter jets. He found his man lighting a cigarette way up by the bow, looking across the water to New Jersey, as if the boat were on its way there. He looked a little nervous at Adam's approach. "Cheese it, the cops," he said. "Why did you show me that watch?" Adam asked him. "How did you know I wasn't some friend of that guy's?" He shrugged. "He was laughing," he said, "whereas you look pissed just to be here. Where did you learn to do that? What are you, like some child of the streets or something? Did you even pay to get in here?" Once he realized Adam wasn't there to bust him, the kid relaxed a bit. "Somebody gave me his ticket," he said. "His boss paid for it because he believes in giving back. I'd love to tell you some Oliver Twist bullshit, but the truth is a whole lot geekier. I used to do magic, right through high school. I can get wallets, too. Want to see?" "Where do you work?" "Say I'm a broker," Adam thought. "I'm a broker at Merrill Lynch. What about you?" Adam didn't answer. You could never, ever go back to this moment in time, he was thinking, to this one permutation of the random. It wasn't about fate. Fate was bullshit. It was about a moment's potential and what you did with it. Unrealized potential was a tragic thing. "Do you know how perfect this is?" he said out loud. "There's no connection between us at all. We don't know each other. We don't work together. We didn't go to the same school. I don't even know your name. Your name isn't even on the guest list here." "Wait," the kid said, "don't tell me. Strangers on a train." "You're not going to give that asshole back his watch, are you?" Adam said. A little smirk that Adam hadn't even realized was there suddenly faded from the kid's face. The inchoate patter of the band leader beneath them and the tidal rush of the Hudson below them were like one sound. He looked at Adam and swallowed. "No," he said. "Why not?" "Because fuck him. That's why not." The adrenaline was pounding through him now. He hadn't felt like this since he proposed. Without turning, he gestured over his shoulder toward the party, which they could hear but not see. "They're all like him," Adam said. "They wear a uniform to make it easier to tell. They give us gifts, like tickets to benefits, to make us forget that life is short. We can't just wait around. We don't have that kind of time." "We who?" the kid said. "We happy few," Adam said. "You and me. It's time to bum rush the show. It's time to change the terms. It's going to require some bravery on your part." What was scary was how immediately all this came to him when he hadn't even really known it was there. An urge for vengeance, sure, but vengeance against what? He used to be a leader. He'd never done what others his age were doing. He was always in too much of a hurry, and yet somehow that hurry, instead of bringing him the life he wanted, had marginalized him. Now all of a sudden the margin seemed like the only place to be. As for the kid, Adam could tell from the look of terror on his face that he was not wrong about him. "I don't know what you're talking about," the kid said, which was the right thing to say. "Yes, you do," Adam said. "I'm going to tell you something now. You don't need to do anything but hear it. Wisconsin cryogenics. Can you remember that without writing it down?" He nodded. "Now you can do with that what you will. If you like, it can just be my little gift to you. And that can be the end, but it doesn't have to be the end." They froze and watched a man and a woman, both holding martini glasses, stoop to walk under the stilled blades of a helicopter. Drunkenly, they climbed inside. Music started up again within the ship. "Give me a number," Adam said. "Not a work number or a home number. Maybe like a girlfriend's cell. I'm going to contact you in about 3 weeks, okay? 3 weeks. Then we'll either talk about the future or you can just hang up on me. My name is Adam. The kid was right with him. He whispered a number, and Adam recited it back. Once he had a number in his head, he didn't forget it. One more thing, Adam said. Give me the watch. The kid was confused but handed it over. Adam had a quick look at it, a gold Patek Philippe. He wasn't much into watches himself, but he appreciated value. He pursed his lips respectfully, and then he threw it over the side. Back at the table, he found Cynthia sitting with Parker and Brennan and one or two of the others, all of whom were too drunk and needed to go home. Cynthia, still glowing from all the dancing, glared teasingly at him. Leave a lady hanging, why don't you? She said. Where have you been, anyway? He told her he'd run into some old friends from Morgan Stanley. It was the easiest lie he ever told. Parker staggered around the table to say goodbye to her. He bent over with drunken gravitas and kissed her hand, and she laughed, and Adam thought how right she was. You couldn't just do nothing. It wasn't enough to trust in your future. You had to seize your future, pull it up out of the stream of time, and in doing so, you separated yourself from the legions of pathetic, sullen yes-men who had faith in the world as a patrimony. That kind of meek belief in the ultimate justice of things was not in Adam's makeup. He'd give their children everything, too, risk anything for them. He knew what he was risking. But it was all a test of your fitness, anyway. The noblest risks were the secret ones. Sanford talked a good game, but he wasn't about to give up what was his, except maybe in his will, just like all the other bloated old satyrs capering around on this big docked ship. As for Adam, when he was lying speechless in some hospital bed after his third coronary, everybody would think he was thinking about one thing, but he would be thinking about something else. Thank you.
So, questions, comments, anything you'd like to talk about? There's a mic, I think. Two mics. Anybody want to ask either of our authors anything?
Can I go back?
You can do whatever you want.
Mr. Ferris, I had a question for you regarding your new book. The professor introduced you said that the book dealt with marriage and family, and it obviously does. But the book seemed to have other things to say, maybe about addiction and things like that. And I wondered if you, when you wrote the book, had other things in mind rather than just the family.
Well, I had disease in mind, first and foremost. I wanted to write. Can everybody hear me okay? I wanted to write about disease, first and foremost. And I wanted to do it in a way that didn't drag behind it all of the pre-existing, preconceived notions of what a disease is. So I had to do something that moved away from cancer or other debilitating, fatal diseases in order to sort of feel free to explore what I think of when I think of, like, capital D disease. That was the impulse, to explore how it stripped away at a man's identity. His professional life, his sense of self-worth, his the freedom of his will, and his family. And ultimately, as I was casting about to figure out, like, what it was that made his life worth something, I guess I came back to the old, I suppose some might call it cliche, but I would call it something different, the notion that family matters. So the book kind of tended to the family toward the latter third of the book, just by virtue of the fact that he had nothing and there was nothing essentially to live for except perhaps getting back to them a final time. So that it was about many things, but family kind of somehow at the end, as I was writing it, became preeminent over those other things.
Anybody else? Questions?
The awkward time in which we stare at them and they stare back.
Well, On a follow-up, I guess, to that question, not having yet read your book, but seeing loved ones deal with mental illness, it felt like you were. I saw that experience where the constantly trying to come back to the present or to where they wanted to be, but would wander off. Was that one of the capital D diseases that you had in mind, or was that something that just came through for me, perhaps?
No, I think I had it in mind, and in fact, another impulse that I had when starting the novel was, what's the distinction between a mental disease and a physical disease? It's foremost in the mind of in Tim's mind because he doesn't want it to be a mental disease. He has the, I think, wrong-headed notion that that's somehow more of a burden to bear, or less respected disease. He doesn't want to be labeled crazy, so he wants to prove that it's an organic has an organic physical cause. Of course, because it doesn't really exist, nobody can prove that it's not mental. Eventually, I think that's resolved. Although, I mean, as a person, as somebody who was thinking a lot about this stuff as I was writing the book, it just occurred to me that, you know, like let's take schizophrenia as an example. I mean, schizophrenia can be treated with medicine. So even a disease that we typically think of as being mental in nature does have a physical foundation that can be somehow manipulated by a drug. And so even those things that we typically think of only existing sort of in the head has a physical foundation. And if we can treat schizophrenia, then maybe there are other diseases that are in the head, so to speak, that we just don't have the refinement to understand that physical layer. So we can't really reach it. But I did sort of conclude, and I think the book kind of concludes that it's all based in some kind of physical. It has a physical basis, even if we don't have the tools yet to understand it or fix it.
Thanks. I'm just curious if there's any particular reason why the two of you were paired together for this. Do you know each other?
We just really like each other. We just met tonight, actually.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. So far, so good.
Yeah. Good. Did you respect
each
other's...
I assume it has to do with similar pub dates, right, Andy?
That's part of it. What is it about the writing style that you're interested in the idea of work?
Are you guys familiar with each other's work before this?
I am. I'm a huge fan of Josh's first book, and actually I didn't tell him this yet because we really have only known each other for like 45 minutes, but
I'm not trying to force anything on you.
In fact, I'm gonna sometimes when you go on reading tours and you appear in bookstores, one of the perks is that they let you pick out one book from the whole store that you would like to take with you, and so my last stop was Boston, and I took The Unnamed.
Oh, well, that's very
so
nice.
I'm looking forward to reading it.
Oh, good.
That's how much I think of Then We Came to the End.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. You should. Everybody should know.
Thanks. This is a question for John. I hope I'm getting this right, but I read an interview with you in which I think you said that you begin novels with characters rather than the story necessarily. And I wondered... what about these very complex characters drew you to want to create a story around them?
I don't know that I do it that way. Every time I did it that way this time, I'm always, when it comes time to sit down and start another book, I'm always thinking about what was wrong with the last one and what I should do differently. But I think in a lot of ways I started this one just with the story of a marriage. I mean, I liked... the idea of writing about, I don't know if you know couples like this, but I certainly do, or people who are so perfect for each other that they become sort of toxic to the world around them. You know, there's no sort of checks and balances involved, and Adam and Cynthia, you know, as the years go on, their love becomes more and more epic, but they also become more and more like themselves because there's nothing to restrain them from doing that. And I think, you know, it's a long time ago now, but that came before any of the setting having to do with money or anything like that.
So you didn't want them to be very rich? That wasn't part of the conception of the book. That just happened to them.
I think I knew that Adam, in particular, is somebody. I mean, I'm not kidding when I say I think of it as a setting rather than a subject, because I think that Adam, it's who he is that makes him qualified to succeed in that world. It's not that world that shapes who he is. You know what I mean? So, so I did know that. That would be where he worked, but it was actually a while before I figured out that he would do so well.
Okay.
Questions? This is related to the statement you just made regarding Adam, I guess. As you were reading, you read, the noblest risks are the secret ones, from the point of view of Adam. What is the risk he's considering, and what makes him different from all of the other empty tuxedos at this gathering?
Well, the risk he's considering, you know, is he's conscious that he's committing a criminal act, even just by giving this one tip to the stranger that he meets on the boat. Adam's problem, I mean, it's both his flaw and the secret to his success, I think, is a kind of chronic impatience, and he's not content to wait for his reward. He needs to make it happen, even at not only even at great risk to himself, but like a lot of people I think who work in that world, there's a whole lot of satisfaction associated with the idea of putting yourself at personal risk. Maybe not that kind, but you know, risk in general. So. I think he is. He sees himself as different from everybody else there, and I think in the act that he commits on the boat, he starts to prove himself right, but for better or worse.
Anything else? Questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and I believe they will both be signing books in the lobby.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.